Well, a very warm welcome back to Stratford-upon-Avon, where as part of Radio 3's Sounds of Shakespeare, we have a very special edition of World on 3 for you tonight. The audience has gathered here in the other place where Radio 3 is resident throughout the weekends. We have many musicians waiting in the wings. Some of them are going to be singing Shakespeare's words. Rufus Wainwright will be along later to do that. Peter Knight is here to sing some traditional songs on Shakespearean themes, and we're also going to be joined by musicians who are currently appearing in the Royal Shakespeare Company's African-inspired production of Hamlet. But we're going to start with a singer who we first heard on World on 3 about a month ago, thanks to BBC Introducing, which is a new scheme where BBC Music is asking for yet undiscovered artists to send in their work in the hope that it will be snapped up for broadcast. So here we have Wes Finch, and the first two songs that he's going to sing are from Twelfth Night, and in the play, they're sung by Feste, that fool who loves to be a little bit philosophical, and he likes to badger people about not wallowing in self-pity. So this first song is O Mistress Mine, where he's saying there's no point in waiting for the right person to come along. You might as well just settle for the person who's available right here, right now. Please welcome Wes Finch.
Thank you. Now, the clown in Twelfth Night sings this at the request of Sir Toby and Sir Andrew for the sum of sixpence. I won't reveal what our fee was, but it's a little bit more than that.
Mistress mine, where are you roaming? Oh, stand here, your true love's coming. That can sing both high and low. Trip no further, pretty sweeting. Journey's ending, lovers meeting, every wise man's son doth know. Love, 'tis not hereafter. Present mirth hath present laughter. What's to come is still unsure. In delay there lies no plenty. Then come kiss me, sweet and 20, youth's the stuff will not endure. Thank you.
So from Twelfth Night, the second song from Feste is Come Away Death. About a boy who dies for love. Come away, come away, death, and in sad Cyprus let me be laid. Fly away, breath. I am slain by a fair cruel maid, my shroud of white stuck all with you. Prepare. Heart of death, no one so true did share it. Not a flower sweet on my black coffin, let there be laid. Not a friend greet my poor corpse where my bones shall be thrown.
The voice of Wes Finch, and he's joined here tonight by Jules Street on violin and Ben Haynes on percussion. And that was Come Away Death from Twelfth Night. Wes, you were born in Coventry. You're living now, I know you've travelled a bit, but you're living now in Leamington Spa, so you're probably, you know, he's a Shakespearean boy. Do you find his words easy to set? I mean, obviously it's wonderfully poetic language. How does it lend itself to music?
Well, sure, there's a lot of definite rhythm in there, and some great imagery and great poetry, kind of, well, it stood the test of time, hasn't it? So,
Do you find that it kind of suggests musical melody to you? Because in a way, it is music itself, isn't it? Is it easy to then take it on your own journey, as it were?
I do, yeah. I really relish having words like that ready to be set to music, and I find it lends itself to rhythms and moods quite well. Yeah.
And when these songs crop up in Shakespeare's plays, they're often to kind of sum up a feeling, aren't they? A kind of an emotion, and just to kind of take a step back from the drama and just reflect on a point. Is it when you're writing your own songs, is that something that you find quite useful as well?
Definitely. I mean, you try and convey emotions when you write something like that, but I always think once it's written and performed and given out, it's always open to interpretation in different ways. Yeah,
that's the key thing, isn't it? We're going to hear you sing some sonnets.
Yes.
Sonnet number 5, what's that one all about?
Oh, well, it's about human aging, and it can in a way that's compared to the progress of the seasons. And there's a beautiful image in it about how the essence of flowers can be preserved in perfume. And, you know, that kind of suggests to me the essence of somebody you love can be preserved in a similar way while the physical aspects might fade.
Mm. So after death, the fragrance lives on, kind of thing. Thank you, Wes. So, sonnet number 5 coming up. After we hear a setting here of Sigh No More, and this is from Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing.
Sigh no more, ladies, sigh no more. Men were deceivers ever. 1 foot on the sea and one on shore. To one thing constant, never. Then sigh not so, but let them go, and be you blithe and bonny, converting all your sounds. Hey, nonny, nonny. Sing no more ditties, sing no more. Or dumps so dull and heavy, the fraud of men was ever so. Summer first was leafy. Then sigh not so, but let them go, and be you blithe and bonny, converting all your sounds. Thank you. checked with frost and lusty leaves quite gone. Beauty overstrewn and bareness everywhere. Then were not summer's distillation left, a liquid prisoner pent in walls of glass. Beauty's effect with beauty were breath.
I've heard there's been a few folk artists over the years that have covered How Should I Your True Love Know? It's the song, one of the songs sung by Ophelia in Hamlet as she is being driven mad. This isn't actually Shakespeare's words. It's the second and third stanza of an older folk song called the Walsingham Ballad. But we'll let that slide tonight, right?
How should I your true love know from another one? By his cockle hat and staff and his sandal shoes. He is dead and gone, lady. He is dead and gone. At his head a grass green turf, at his heels a stone. White his shroud as the mountain snow, lotted with sweet flowers. That bewept to the grave did go with true love showers. is dead and gone, lady. He is dead and gone. At his head a grass green turf, at his heels a stone. At his head a grass green turf, at his heels a stone.
Thank you so much. This is Sonnet 109. It's thought to be the first in a series of apologetic sonnets when they were still addressed to a young man of Shakespeare's affections. Should be 16 lines, but if you can forgive us, we've repeated the last couple of lines, so it's going to be 20. Save thou my rose, in it thou art my all.
Sonnet 109. Oh, never say that I was false of heart. It's the voice of Wes Finch, joined on stage here at the Other Place in Stratford by Jules Street and Ben Haynes. Well, if you'd like to get in touch about Shakespeare, you can do so on Twitter using the hashtag ShakespeareLives. But as this is World on Three, we think it is only appropriate that we take a look at Shakespeare through a global lens. So I am joined now by Andrew Dixon. Here he is, who has written a book recently about Shakespeare's fascination with the world and also the world's fascination, of course, with Shakespeare. Andrew, I mean, has he gone to every single corner of the globe?
It's hard to think of a corner of the globe that he hasn't somehow reached. I mean, as you were saying, it feels entirely appropriate to talk about Shakespeare on a programme about world music because he is the world's playwright. I can't think of another writer who has been more translated, more adapted, created in more forms. You know, he's been performed on whaling ships in the South Pacific, in the middle of the American Wild West. He's been translated into German and became a favourite in Nazi Germany. He's been performed in apartheid South Africa, reached China and India. Apparently, there's even a version of Hamlet in Klingon from Star Trek. So it's not just this world, other worlds as well.
And you spent 2 years or so going across four continents or something to research this book. I mean, what were some really surprising things for you?
I think actually it was just finding out how Shakespeare is important in the world. You know, I think particularly maybe in Stratford-upon-Avon, we tend to think of him as a British writer, you know, someone who is sort of intimately bound up with our national identity in the UK. Actually, there are more performances of Shakespeare done in Germany every year than there are in England. You know, there are more versions of Shakespearean stories in cinema in India than anywhere else in the world. So actually, it was, to be honest, certain places I thought, are people really going to want to talk to me about Shakespeare here? And yes, they do. You know, cab drivers in China and India suddenly having conversations with you about Othello or Much Ado About Nothing.
We're going to concentrate on China and India tonight just because time constraints mean we can't go around the whole world. Let's start with China. When did Shakespeare first appear in China? Is it possible to say?
It is possible to say, actually, and it's really recent in global terms. So it's only 1903 is pretty much the first translation of Shakespeare. So it's only just over a century. But the fascinating thing is that Shakespeare wasn't translated as drama in China. The stories reached China by a really circuitous route. Basically, the Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare, hugely popular in the 19th century, these sort of bedtime story versions of Shakespeare, were translated, hugely popular in Asia, translated into Japanese, and then those Japanese versions were translated into Chinese. So the interesting thing about Shakespeare in China when he first arrives is that he's a short story writer, basically. The plays are sort of repackaged as mass market fiction, and they're also aimed at male readerships as well. So you get these wonderful things like The Two Gentlemen of Verona. It's translated under the title Proteus Sells Out His Close Friend for Lust. Really sensationalistic. And that's how they become absorbed into Chinese culture. The first translation is actually called Strange Tales from Overseas, which is kind of nice, isn't it? Because we sort of think of Shakespeare as being very knowable. Actually, of course, for on the other side of the world, he was really strange and exotic.
Yeah. And then, of course, comes the Revolution. So what happens to Shakespeare during the Revolution?
Well, Shakespeare totally disappears from Chinese stages, having been really very popular in China very, very quickly. Mao is quite a fan of internationalist culture and of making Chinese culture connect with the rest of the world's culture. All of a sudden, the Cultural Revolution happens in 1966, and all international writers, all international culture is banned. And I think Shakespeare, there's a sort of particular sense that he's a very dangerous writer, probably because, you know, he's an intellectual, he's the sort of uber intellectual, but also because he's foreign, he's non-Chinese. So basically for a 10-year period, there was no Shakespeare on Chinese stages at all.
Let's just have a listen now to what people were allowed to listen to, in effect, and participate in fact, really, during the Revolution. This is part of an opera that was written to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. And this production involved over 3,000 workers, students and peasants. And you can hear them here on a long march, which is the march across China, led by Mao, as he gathered his forces for his communist revolution.
抬头望见指路灯，心中想念毛泽东，迷路时想你有方向，黑夜里想你照路程，困难时想你有力量。 上帝时想你心里明。
So that's the Long March from The East is Red. Peasants and students and soldiers from the People's Republic of China, recorded in 1971. It's kind of rousing stuff, isn't it?
It makes you want to stand up and salute, doesn't it?
Does.
I don't know about you. I mean, the joke was in China that for 10 years of the Cultural Revolution, 6 million people watched six shows because these were the only things that would be permitted on stage. So you'd have that kind of music blaring out in public places, playing in shops. Those are the only records you could buy. It was astonishing, a complete destruction of every other kind of culture.
Thank you, Andrew. We're going to talk later. But if you were listening to In Tune earlier, you'll know that currently running here in Stratford-upon-Avon is Simon Godwin's acclaimed production of Hamlet, a tragedy, of course, full of anger, revenge, murder and madness. But this particular production had a fascinating gestation. An almost entirely black cast who were first invited to come together and explore the play through their African roots. And that went for the musicians involved as much as the actors. The music was masterminded by Shola Akimbola, who's been the percussionist for Jamiroquai for the past 20 years, but whose Nigerian roots have never left him. He's here now on stage with us at the other place with the guitarist Joe Archer, flautist Dirk Campbell, djembe star Siddiqui Djembele, and the actress playing the role of Ophelia in this production, Natalie Simpson. So they're going to start now with Ophelia's themes.
Should I your true love know from another one by his cockle hat and staff and his sandal shoon? How should I your true love know from another one by his cockle hat and staff and his sandal shoon? He is dead. Thank you.
Ophelia's theme, sung by Natalie Simpson, who is currently playing Ophelia in the Royal Shakespeare Company's production of Hamlet, music written by Shola Akinbola. Sounds like a fascinating process that you came to write the music for this play, Shola. Just explain a bit about how it worked.
Well, first of all, I have to thank the wonderful Kate Godfrey, the head of voice at the IRC. She introduced me to the idea of the iambic pentameter, which is Shakespeare's own.
Just remind us, we all did it at school.
Yes.
But go on.
So the five beats. So Shakespeare has his own rhythmic structure in his work, and I therefore was able to simply find a way to interpret that musically from a slightly different perspective.
Is that a way that you'd ever approach music before?
Not really, no. Not really.
So very new experience.
It was very, very interesting, yes.
A long way from the pop world.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So did you score it all out?
That was achieved by the wonderful John Nichols. So it was a very organic process in the rehearsal room. I tended to watch the scenes and try and get a sense of what the emotional energy was coming into the scene or going out of the scene and try to improvise around that. And then John was brilliantly scoring the ideas for me as they flowed out of my head, because it was difficult to remember what I did 5 minutes ago.
Can you give us a sense of give us a sense of how it looks on the stage for those who haven't seen it?
Well, it's a feast. It's a spectacle for the eyes and ears and body.
And so the musicians are on the stage.
The musicians are, some of us, myself, Dirk, and Siddiqui are on stage and off stage.
So you're drumming.
So yeah, so we're keeping that iambic pulse.
Yeah.
It's been a fantastic experience.
And with the ghost, I understand you're leading the ghost.
The idea is that we're calling the ghosts. So in Yoruba they call it to greet the king. So we're greeting the king with the drums, using the language of the drums, which ties in with the language of the piece. It's all about language and how it links musically and rhythmically.
Talking of drums, that song was absolutely beautiful. Natalie, thank you.
Well done,
but can we hear the drums now? What are you going to...
The drums? Sure. Okay, sure.
The notes, just tell us a little bit about the next piece, The Fight Ritual.
Yes, so this piece is do I need to give it away? Have some people seen it or have they not seen it?
Show of hands.
It leads into a fight scene. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
All right.
Right. Brace yourselves.
With the drums.
Exhilarating stuff. Music from the current production of Hamlet's being staged here in Stratford. It's on until mid-August, if you haven't seen it. And then from the beginning of June, it's also going to be screened in cinemas around the UK. So no excuse not to go and see it. Music by the percussionist Shola Akingbola, played by Dirk Campbell, Siddiqui Jembele, Joe Archer and Natalie Simpson. Still to come on World on 3 tonight, we have Rufus Wainwright, who is going to join us. He's just released an album of Shakespeare's sonnets, so he's going to be coming along to sing some of those for us. And this is all part of Radio 3's Sounds of Shakespeare. We've even brought our own studio with us. It's a pop-up studio. You can't miss it. You come into the other place here in Stratford, and it's right there. It's got glass walls, so not only can you hear Radio 3, you can also see it too. And this is just the beginning of a whole weekend of events, all of which will, of course, be available for you online as well. I'm joined again by the writer, Andrew Dixon, whose recent book is called Worlds Elsewhere, Journeys Around Shakespeare's Globe. We were talking, Andrew, about China. Let's just talk a little bit now about India. And India, of course, crops up in Shakespeare's plays. I'm always amazed that the world crops up in Shakespeare's plays, given that did he go much further himself than Stratford?
Well, not really. Stratford and London. I mean, basically, Shakespeare, as far as you can plot him on a map, his life basically exists in the M40 motorway corridor. moves between London and Stratford, Stratford and London, and that's the way that it goes. But the fascinating thing, as you say, is that the plays are set in all of these places. Venice, Verona, Venice. I mean, so few of them are actually set in anything like Elizabethan England. And the Indies does crop up. So Midsummer Night's Dream, there's a sort of tantalising subplot between Oberon and Titania, the fairy queen and king, about a mysterious Indian boy who's somehow gone missing, and you see the Indies cropping up. But of course, Shakespeare doesn't just mean India by that. That means also Southeast Asia, the East Indies, as they were known, and the West Indies as well, so the Americas. So Shakespeare's world is really kind of porous and ever-expanding, I think.
Yeah. So when does Shakespeare's work get to India? I imagine through colonisation.
It is, basically, yeah. It's because of the British in the 19th century. So the British invade India, they start taking it over, and as well as bringing Shakespeare with them as a kind of way of passing the off hours, so lots of British officers perform Amdram versions of Shakespeare. The moment the kind of governmental system begins to settle in the 1840s, 1850s, the education system begins to settle in. And so the idea is that what you want to do is, quote, civilize India, so you make it as British as possible. You teach people English, you teach them about the English legal system and the Bible, and you also teach them Englit, so Shakespeare. But I think the fascinating thing is that the kind of bard bites back, basically, because you have all of these versions of Shakespeare which are adapted and translated. So the British kind of export Shakespeare to India as a colonial writer, but very quickly he becomes something different. So all of a sudden there are hundreds of adaptations of the plays in every Indian language. People are doing crazy adaptations which meld bits of Much Ado About Nothing with sections of Othello. And particularly in Mumbai in the 1880s and 90s, you get this amazing drama that's created using Shakespeare, the Arabian Nights, bits of the Mahabharata, all kind of combined in a big melting pot, basically.
And music becomes key, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, because Parsi theatre, as it's known in Mumbai in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, is really musical. And the idea is that these are kind of as much operas as they are plays. And so the songs that are written aren't necessarily Shakespearean songs. They're not using the text by this stage. They're using adaptations and translations. But the songs are really, really crucial to driving home the message of the play. And then this, of course, becomes Bollywood, because a lot of these plays get filmed. And in fact, the very earliest talky sound version of Hamlet anywhere in the world is Indian. It's from 1935. It doesn't exist, unfortunately, any longer, but it was filled with songs.
Isn't that amazing? And he's still big in Bollywood.
He's still huge in Bollywood. You know, if you watch a Bollywood film, probably there will be a reference to Shakespeare somewhere in it, whether it's conscious or not. You know, he's not often credited, but the ideas are there, the characters are there, the plots are there. I watched an amazing film called Bodyguard, which is a version of a Whitney Houston movie, the American one, the Kevin Costner one from the 1980s. But it has an entire section in it borrowed from As You Like It, like with no credit, no reference to it. It's just that obviously the screenwriter thought, oh, that's a good idea, let's just steal it.
So who are some of the sort of big name directors of the day now, who are working now, who are dealing with Shakespeare?
Well, probably the most important one is a guy called Vishal Bardwaj. And I think Bardwaj and Bard, that is purely accidental, he told me when I met him in Mumbai. But basically, he's a film director. He's become very, very well known because he's done adaptations of Shakespeare. But he started as a composer, like a lot of directors in Bollywood, because the songs are so important to the films, both commercially and also in terms of like their artistic integrity. So he's about 50 now. He grew up in Uttar Pradesh, the northern state, quite rural, quite poor. And he broke through in 2005 with this astonishing version of Macbeth called Makbul, which is set in contemporary Mumbai. It's a crime drama. It's as much the Godfather as is Shakespeare. And then he's done two subsequent movies. So there's a version of Othello called Omkara, which is set in Uttar Pradesh. And the most recent one is Haider, which is Hamlet, which came out just in 2014. And that's the interesting thing about them. They're Shakespearean, but they're not Shakespearean. They kind of borrow from Shakespeare. They borrow bits of the plot and characters, but they're full of songs. They're totally Indianized. They're made completely localized, basically. They're fantastic movies.
And do the people who are watching in India know it's Shakespeare? I mean, is it on the billing, adapted from Shakespeare, or is Shakespeare a bit of a kind of, ooh?
Well, that's the interesting thing, actually. People do know it's Shakespeare because knowledge of Shakespeare is still hugely prevalent in India. I think the British Council did a survey the other day asking which country most loved Shakespeare, and India came top of the survey. But yes, they do know it's Shakespeare. The fascinating thing is that whereas I think in the West sometimes, particularly in cinema, filmmakers get a bit frightened by Shakespeare. They're a bit over-reverent and they get a bit worried about the text and stuff like that. In India, there's very, very little of that. When I interviewed Bardwaj in Mumbai a couple of years ago, he said to me, the great thing about Shakespeare is that we don't treat him with reverence here. You know, if I'm having a problem with one of his plays, making it into a film, I kind of say to him, let's just sit down, we'll have a drink, we'll talk it out. You know, it's really nice, because I think in this country we have him on a pedestal all the time.
We don't, unfortunately, have directly music where he's used in a Shakespearean film, but we do have some of Bardwaj's music. Here is a song which features the voice of his wife, Redka.
राख से रूखी कोयल से काली रात कटे ना हिजरा तेरे इश्क में
Music by Vishal Bhardwaj. He's a master at bringing Bollywood together with Shakespeare. And my thanks to the writer Andrew Dixon, author of Worlds Elsewhere, Journeys Around Shakespeare's Globe. You're listening to World on Three, on stage at The Other Place in Stratford, as part of Sounds of Shakespeare, which is Radio 3's weekend celebration, marking 400 years since the playwright's death. We're going to hear sonnets later, but now we're going to hear some folk songs, which have a clear resonance with some of Shakespeare's themes. And these have been chosen by Gig Spanner, a trio headed up by the violinist and singer Peter Knight, who was a member for many years of that great folk rock group Steel Eye Span. He left them for the second time, I think it was, wasn't it, Peter, in 2013? And since then, he's been channeling his energy into this trio, who take inspiration from all over the globe. And the late Sir Terry Pratchett said of Peter that he can spin the world on his bow, which is a lovely quote. Adding considerably to that sound in this trio is Vincent Salvas, who plays congas and djembe and learnt his trade in both Senegal and Cuba. And then we have guitarist Roger Flack, who's a founding member of the Celtic rock band The Tabs. So please welcome Gig Spanner. Thank you. Gigspanner's take on the tune She Moved Through the Fair. What a wonderfully eerie tune that is, isn't it, Peter?
Thank you. I think we've run on a bit too long. We can't stop sometimes when we start.
I suppose we don't know the origins of that tune, do
we? No, but it is about death. We're good at death. All of our songs are about death in some way, yeah.
Do you know, I detect something of the Indian about your violin style. Am I right there, or are you just absorbing sort of styles from all around?
The lovely thing about music these days is that we live in a small world and all music is accessible. And as a musician, what I like to do is to let the music feed in sort of subliminally. I don't like learning the licks.
No.
But
you're a bit of a free jazzer as well, aren't you?
Well, I'm sort of quite free with it, really, anyway, you know. But and there's a lot of improvisation in what we do. And what I like to do with improvising is to intrigue people and not alienate them, because that's very easy to do.
You're certainly doing that for us tonight. You were here in Stratford, weren't you, about 3 years ago, invited to do some music for a project at Anne Hathaway's cottage. Was that an inspiring...
Oh, it was incredible, yeah. Well, I mean, we were talking earlier. I went to a secondary modern school. I failed my 11 plus miserably. And at the same time, I was going to the Royal Academy of Music. And I don't think the teachers at the school that I went to knew who Shakespeare was. So when I was commissioned by the Shakespeare Trust to write some 20 minutes of music for a woodland walk at Anne Hathaway's cottage, I did say to my wife as we drove there, I said, I might well decline, because I don't know much about all of this. But as soon as I walked through the archway, it was just transforming immediately, because I love woods and I know a bit about love. And the thought of Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway, maybe not in that wood, I think they were walking in another wood, but then the ideas of maybe the words sort of rustling, some of the sonnets and whatever rustling. So then I got involved, yeah. And it's lovely. It was lovely reading some of the sonnets that were involving woodland, particularly, yeah.
So Shakespeare gets to us all, doesn't he, in the end, in mysterious ways.
He made me cry.
Oh.
And it's never specific, is it? That one where something emotionally touches you. You're never quite sure
what it is. I cry at anything.
Yeah, I do too. Shall we have a good cry?
So, thank you, Peter. You're here tonight with a couple of songs that are from the English tradition, but that have resonance with some of Shakespeare's themes. And in fact, this first one that we're going to hear now, the theme is sibling rivalry, which certainly crops up in The Tempest. But this is The Beaux of London, or The Two Sisters, as it's also known, a murder ballad, we like those, in which a jealous sister pushes her younger sibling into a river and refuses to rescue her. And she floats downstream, and when her body eventually floats ashore, an instrument maker finds it, and he turns it into a fiddle. But then that fiddle comes to life, and then it'll only obsessively play one tune, and that tune is The Bonnie Bonnie Beaux of London.
Sisters are walking along, hey, the gay and the grinding. Two little sisters walking along by the bonny, bonny boughs of London. And the eldest pushed her sister in, hey, the gay and the grinding. She pushed her sister into the stream by the bonny, bonny boughs of London. She pushed her in and she watched her drown, hey, the gay and the grinding. She watched her body floating down by the bonny, bonny boughs of London. And he floated up and he floated down, hey, the gay and the grinding. Until she came to the miller's dam by the bonny, bonny boughs of London. And out and came the miller's son, hey, the gay and the grinding. Oh, father dear, here swims a swan by the bonny, bonny boughs of London. So they laid her out on the bank to die, hey, the gay and the grinding. When a fool with a fiddle came riding by the bonny, bonny boughs of London. And he cut some strands of her long yellow hair, hey, the gay and the grinding. got some strands of her long yellow hair by the bonny, bonny bows of London. And he made fiddle strings from this yellow hair, hey, the gay and the grinding. He made fiddle strings from her long yellow hair by the bonny, bonny bows of London. And he made fiddle pegs from her finger bones, hey, the gay and the grinding. He made fiddle pegs from her finger bones by the bonny, bonny bows of London. And he made a fiddle out of her breastbone, hey, the gay and the grinding. And the sound would pierce her heart of stone by the bonny, bonny bows of London. But the only tune that the fiddle would play was all the bows of London. The only tune that the fiddle would play was the bonny, bonny bows of London. Sits my father the king, hey, the gay and the grinding. Yonder sits my father the king by the bonny, bonny bows of London. And yonder sits my mother the queen, hey, the gay and the grinding. Oh, how she'll grieve at my burying by the bonny, bonny bows of London. And yonder sits my sister Anne, hey, the gay and the grinding. It was she who drowned me in the stream by the bonny, bonny bows of London. This next song, Death and the Lady, might almost be a deconstructed Romeo and Juliet. Thank you. I walked out one day, one day. I met an old man all on the way. His head was bald and his beard was grey. His clothing made of the cold earth and clay. His clothing made of the cold earth and clay. I said, old man, what man are you? What country do you belong unto? My name is Death, have you heard of me? All kings and princes bow down unto me. And you, fair maid, must come along with me. Oh, I'll give you gold and I'll give you pearl. I'll give you costly rich robes to wear. If you will grant me just a little while and give me time my life to amend. And give me time my life to amend. Oh, I want no gold and I want no pearl. I want no costly rich robes to wear. And I cannot grant you just a little while or give you time your life to amend. Or give you time your life to amend. She cried, here lies a poor distracted maid, who in her youth she was taken away. Her clothing made of the cold earth and clay. Thank you.
So a conversation between the Grim Reaper and a beautiful young maiden, Death and the Lady, as performed here at The Other Place in Stratford-upon-Avon by Peter Knight's Gig Spanner. And I think we all now want one of those shiny purple octave fiddles that can kind of turn itself into something resembling an electric guitar. Fantastic. Well, finally tonight, we are going to be joined by the soulful Rufus Wainwright for a few Shakespearean sonnets. So while we get the piano set center stage here, let's just go to a part of the world that we haven't heard from tonight, South America, and hear some music from the Colombian superstar Carlos Vives, preceded by the virtuoso accordionist Lulinia Alenca, playing music by Luis Gonzaga, who's one of the greatest exponents of traditional music from the northeast of Brazil. And this is a piece called Aquele Chorinho.
Ah.
Music by the great Carlos Vives, who is going to be in the UK for the first time in June. So do look out for that. And you can hear more of Lulinya Alenka soon on World on 3, on Radio 3, with a session that we recorded in Brazil. And that's going to be broadcast to coincide with the Rio Olympics. You're listening to World on 3. Our final guest for Sounds of Shakespeare is not just a songwriter, he's also an opera composer. We broadcast his full-blown opera, Prima Donna, on Radio 3 not so long ago. He also has many albums of his own songs to his name, many original songs, but his latest album, released today, borrows words from Shakespeare. Please welcome Rufus Wainwright. Radio 3 today, Rufus. BBC 2 tomorrow, or yes. Part of Shakespeare Live. What's that all about? Sounds like a great party.
Yeah, no, it just so happens that I happen to have 9 Shakespeare sonnets that I'd written music to, which I had kind of lying around. And Deutsche Grammophon, my label, after we'd done Prima Donna together, which was a great success, they said, well, what else can we do? And we just realized that this was probably a good time to make that sonnets record. And here
all.
I am today.
Well done, you. So Shakespeare, we're talking about Shakespeare's kind of traveling around the globe. You grew up, obviously, in Montreal, yes. In Canada. Were you introduced to Shakespeare at school, or...?
Well, my mother loved the sonnets and also the plays, but yeah, no, I was introduced early on. I think even I went to see something like, you know, King Henry IV part something or other when I was about 4, and right. I remember a lot of swords. But it was always around.
And did the sonnets in particular kind of grab you when you?
No, they did. I mean, I've been telling this story a lot because so it seems like everybody's heard it, but I guess not. But my mother.
I haven't.
Okay. Well, my mom, my mother was a single mother at the time, and
Kate McGarrigle. Let's just
say. Yes, the great Kate McGarrigle, and she was a slightly, she I don't think she quite knew how to handle a teenage boy coming of age, you know, and hitting puberty, and she noticed. I think mostly when she was doing the laundry that something was going on in my room. and what she did one day, she said, Rufus, there's a sonnet by Shakespeare where he's talking about what you're doing. And it was The Expensive Spirit and A Waste of Shame. Whatever. God rest her soul. And she handed me that and kind of left. And that was my big talk.
Oh.
Explains a lot.
And of course, when the sonnets are where Shakespeare really kind of shines a light on gender,
yes.
Doesn't he? I mean, he was a married man, 3 children, but obviously very attracted to men as well. So is that kind of what interests you as well?
What I find fascinating is that arguably to this day, no other writer has so fully illustrated all of those issues with gender and sexuality and women's lib or homosexual tendencies. I mean, it's all in there, and it's really has not been surpassed yet. How he has captured the complexity of all those different confusing roles, which right now we're really the can has been opened now, and it's so mainstream that it's kind of fascinating.
And you've got 9 on your album,
yes.
But there are over 150 years.
There's 154, I think.
Yeah. So was it easy to choose, or did you get a selection?
Well, it was a long-term process because I had to do the mama sonnet, and I've always loved A Woman's Face, sonnet number 20, and also When in Disgrace with Fortune in Men's Eyes, but. I was also doing this with Robert Wilson. That was when I wrote the majority of the sonnets was for the Berlin Ensemble, which is a fantastic theater where the Threepenny Opera was premiered in Germany. So that was a kind of group effort to realize which sonnets we would do, but I kind of think you could take any of them and do anything with them, and they probably sound pretty good.
Yeah. Do they lend themselves, you know, to the music that you want to write, or do you have to listen to the sonnet and it gives the music to you?
I choose not to think too hard about it when I'm writing music for a Shakespeare situation. You know, I really let him take the lead and just see what comes up instinctually. And, you know, some critics can hear that and or can be quite dismissive. But in general, I think my approach is probably wiser, because you're never gonna, you know, surpass him in your intellectualizing. So I try to make it very natural and very melodic and just be sort of a conduit.
And do you kind of hope? I mean, given your, you know, formidable reputation now and. You know, you are out there talking to a younger audience. You know, you're introducing his work to new listeners.
Yes. I am. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, I'm 42 now, and I grew up when I was coming out of the closet. I was very young. I was about 13 or 14 when I knew what was going on. Anyways, but at that point, at that time period, it was such a different world. There was no internet. There was no real support groups. There was, you know, AIDS was rampant. And so for me, it was really necessary to latch on to high culture, you know, as a sort of weather vane, you know. And there was this, whether it was Shakespeare or whether it was, you know, opera or Oscar Wilde or whoever, that was very important to me. And I think now things are probably better for gay people or questioning people, and that's a good thing. But you also don't want to lose a bit of that sort of instinct to I don't know, just learn how people survived in the past, because I don't know, it could all be taken away so quickly.
Yeah.
And
we're going to hear you sing a couple of sonnets for us tonight and a couple of your own songs.
Yeah.
Sonnet 43, which is called When Most I Wink. What's going on there?
Well, When Most I Wink is about sleeping. Winking is taking a wink. And like a nap. Isn't that right? No.
They're just
okay. It's not the other W word. So it's about that. And what I love about that sonnet, I'll play that second after my first piece, but is that the album starts with that sonnet, When Most I Wink, and it's about entering into a dream world where, you know, it's just a far more idyllic situation than the one that you actually live in, that the poet lives in. And then the final sonnet on my album, Take All My Loves, 9 Shakespeare sonnets, is Farewell, Thou Art Too Good for My Possessing. And it ends with the listener waking up. The writer, listening up. So I think the whole album is a dream, which the sonnets are basically just dreams, I feel, in a lot of ways.
Thank you, Rufus. So sonnet 43, preceded by a song of yours.
Yes.
Called
The Art Teacher. It's a good warm-up track.
At least you're honest.
Yes. Would you like me to do it now?
Please.
Okay.
Thank you for coming. Rufus Wainwright.
I love
For Shakespeare, and I would like to thank William Shakespeare for being so kind to write these sonnets for my album and also give me all of the publishing. Thank you so much. So when most I wink, then do mine eyes best see.
When I sleep in dreams, they look
Another warm-up song now for one of my tunes. This is about my daughter Viva Cohen, who I will be more. I won't just throw her a sonnet.
Around. Thank you.
The inspired and the inspiring Rufus Wainwright. Radio 3 is going to be back in Stratford-upon-Avon for breakfast at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, followed by Record Review, all coming live from our pop-up studio here at The Other Place, and featuring music inspired by Shakespeare. But for now, it is good night from World on 3, and with a warm thanks to all the musicians and, of course, to the audience who joined us here tonight. We'll just leave you now with one last sonnet from Rufus Wainwright and Shakespeare, of course, and this is A Woman's Face.
There.